Why do Old Testament passages give us such a bloody path to the way to the Prince of Peace? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author. This week we are continuing our series on the biblical book of Isaiah. My conversation partners are again Jody Washburn and Matilda Fry, both teachers in the Walla Walla University School of Theology. Now, let's go to that leading question. Why do the Old Testament passages give us such a bloody path to the way of the Prince of Peace? Now, this section of Isaiah covers from Isaiah 9 to 12, and these chapters include some of the most precious passages for Christians. Chapter 9 includes the hymn, "For a Child is Born." It also includes the passage that I mentioned earlier as my favorite, "God's Vegetarian Kingdom." But interspersed with these wonderful promises is a great deal of blood and warfare. Indeed, immediately following the vision of the peaceable kingdom, Isaiah describes the recovery of Israel's remnant with force and bloodshed. So, you folks have told me that I exaggerate the violence in the Old Testament, so now is your chance to put in a corrective.
The only comment that I have here is, and this is probably dangerous to say, but must we read everything here as God's ideal? What I mean by that is I see so much language being chosen that would make sense in the paradigm of the audience that's being spoken to. And it seems to me throughout the Bible, not just in these really like very vivid and violent oracles that we find in the prophetic texts, but all the way through the biblical text, we have this God who is not at all intimidated with messiness. I mean, just recently a friend was sharing with me a quote of someone reading about Jesus. I mean, we don't like to think about the baby Jesus, right? Biting while nursing. We don't like to think about the blood of the birth. We don't like to think about cleaning up vomit. But God, throughout the Bible, is pictured as not being intimidated by this messiness. So I guess I wonder two things. If this is a sense in which God enters into the messiness, and also maybe we read too much of God's ideal into these texts when they are perhaps more descriptive.
I also think that if you look into the Bible in your hard copy Bible, chapter 9, 10, 11 are all, it is visible in the text that this is highly poetic language. And any kind of poetry is the means to exaggerate. Is the way to put things in an overstated manner. And that has a purpose, so it becomes very clear, very visible to the people. And we have that in the book of Isaiah so much, so that we have to keep that in the back of our minds when we read texts about violence and murder and bloodshed and so on.
So would you think I was horribly violent if I came and alluded to you that I was so exasperated over a situation that I felt like killing, you know, fill in the blank with whoever has just interacted with me? I'm thinking of examples, right? That this is not just in the Hebrew Bible or the Bible overall, but we still use hyperbole in this way. And there's a sense in which when you're in the interaction, there are so many other things that you're reading, so to speak.
One of the things that we find particularly in the Psalms is that Psalms is a very open book. This is not God speaking. These are God's people speaking to God. And they have the full gamut of emotions. Mm-hmm. And as long as we recognize that this is not the ideal, but when you're dealing with different people, it makes all the difference in the world. Now, sometimes, and of course, I tend to take a very strong accommodationist approach to Scripture. And I, at least twice in recent months when I've been holding seminars, and I can vividly remember these, I talk about the differences in children. And as a model for why we deal with people in different ways. I deal with my two young daughters when they were growing up. One was, to use the shorthand, carry me, Daddy. The other one, let me do it. See? Both of them have an implied critique as to the father's approach, because carry me, Daddy, if I thought she needed to be carried, I would have been carrying her anyway. And let me do it, if I thought she could do it, I probably would have let her do it. See? But, you know, that's evened out as they have matured. But that's certainly the case. But in these cases where my listeners have objected to what I was saying, I finally simply said, how many children do you have? One. And I simply said, that's your problem. And everybody laughed. So there is a real difference in the, how you deal with people. And I don't think that we need to necessarily say it's just, it's always going to be violence. But one question I have, when it comes to the child of Isaiah 11, and I don't know whether we need to read that passage, unto us a child is born. No, that's not 11, that's chapter 9. Unto us a child is born. People who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them the light has shined. It says, for a child has been born to us, a son given to us. Authority rests upon his shoulders, and he is named Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His authority shall grow continually, for there shall be endless peace. For the throne of David and the kingdom he will establish and uphold it. Now, the description of the child, as I've just read it there, sounds very much like a kingdom of this world. The kind of Messiah that the people of Jesus seem to crave. Yet when Jesus came, he pointed not to the conquering king of Isaiah 11, but to the suffering servant of Isaiah 53. People rejected the suffering servant model. Couldn't they point to Scripture to justify their rejection of the suffering service idea?
Absolutely.
In fact, the idea of a substitute, Isaiah 53, in Jesus' day, nobody wanted to believe that. Not the disciples, not the Jews. It was only after the resurrection that it finally came clear to that. Now, one other question that I think we need to address here is the exalted language used in Isaiah 11, this is poetic, to describe the person and mission of the coming deliverer, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, yet the messianic prophecies in the narrow sense did not see the Messiah as a divine figure. He was the anointed one, but not understood as God incarnate until after the resurrection. And many people don't realize that the term anointed, which in Greek was Christos and Messiah in Hebrew, that could be applied to anybody who was anointed. And if you really want to shake up your understanding for a bit, one of the reasons why David felt so keenly about Saul, he says, how could I do this and sin against the Lord's anointed? But if you put the word Christ in there, boy, all of a sudden it wakes you up. How could I do this great evil and sin against the Lord's Christ? See, only in the course of time did the anointed one become known as Jesus. Now, let's shift gears. Isaiah 12 brings a psalm of comfort to the people. For though you were angry with me, yet your anger turned away, and you comforted me. It's a beautiful psalm tucked in there in Isaiah 12. From the standpoint of experience, can the believer feel free to claim the promises of God's comfort, even though they may fall short of the ideal?
You've just brought us through little excerpts of both chapter 9 and 11.
Yes.
And it strikes me that the people who chose what to include in the biblical text as we have it certainly were not afraid of us finding out about, for instance, King David's failings, while also seeing King David as very instrumental in bringing about God's shalom, right? In this ongoing story of bringing well-being to the wider world through Israel. And so I think if we read in sort of a zoomed out way, you have an answer in a sense, to your question, that the question is not so much, do I deserve it, perhaps, as it is, am I open to what God is giving? Can I receive it?
Do you think more people need the heavy hand or the gentle hand?
I don't think it's divided between people. I need different things from moment to moment at different points in life when I'm engaging with different people.
To me, the backstory to this section is very helpful to understand that for this king, Ahaz, who, if he had been taken over or overcome by the Syrian king and the northern Israelite king, it could have been easily possible that his kingship would have come to an end, which means that the Davidic throne would have ended with Ahaz. And so these beautiful chapters about a shoot, a new branch that comes on the throne of King David, is the promise that this kingdom will survive, at least in the context of Ahaz and Isaiah, who go back and forth on this. That was important in that small kingdom of Judah in Jerusalem. So that ideal vision of a Davidic kingdom is present in this chapter, so that the hope remains, so that the people hold on to it. And the failure is right there at the same time, with the by going with the Assyrian army, with Tiglath-Pileser, who then enters and destroys the northern Israelites.
It's how God's covenant loyalty is illustrated.
Yes.
Going back to the promise to David.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, we will talk on the theme of playing God, and we'll be focusing on Isaiah 13 and 14 and 24 to 27. Our time is up now. I want to thank Jody and Matilda for their contribution. My thanks to Luke Irvine, who's assisted with the recording today, and to Rick Baskett, our program engineer. Grateful thank you to all of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.